gentlemen of the Commonwealth Club of California, in the absence of Mr. Charles Scully, it is my pleasure to assume the duties of acting quarterly chairman. My name is Raymond Marks. Our speaker next week will be General Mark Clark. His topic will be Training Youth to Meet Communism's Challenges. Our speaker today is the first permanent representative of Libya to the United Nations. He was born in Sebha, Fezzan, Libya, on March 10, 1925, and he received his elementary and high school education in Tunisia. He graduated from the Sorbonne in Paris in 1952 with a PhD in law and political science. In 1953, he entered the Libyan Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and in the same year was appointed Nasser, which is the provincial minister of justice in the province of Tripolitania. A year later, he became Nasser of Interior and later president of the Executive Council in the province of Tripolitania. He participated in the negotiations with the Italian government on the question of former Italian property in Libya, and he also took an active part in the preparatory discussions on Libya's code of law. As a member of the Libyan delegation to the United States in 1954, our speaker helped negotiate the United States-Libyan base agreement, and a year later he served in the same capacity in negotiating the Treaty of Friendship with France. In 1955, while legal advisor to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, he headed the Libyan delegation to the meetings of the Arab League. A year later, he was appointed Federal Minister of Justice. During that year, he served as chairman of the Libyan delegation to the 11th session of the United Nations General Assembly. Early in 1957, he represented Libya in the negotiations with Tunisia to conclude the Treaty of Friendship between the two countries. In October 1957, he served as ambassador of Libya to the United Arab Republic, and in September 1958, he was appointed ambassador to the United States. He is one of the very few privileged to serve in this dual capacity. At the 13th session of the General Assembly, our speaker was the chairman of the Libyan delegation to the United Nations. On the personal side, he is married and has one daughter, Yasmin. It is my honor indeed, gentlemen, to present to you the ambassador to the United States from Libya, His Excellency Dr. Mohideen Fekini.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. President, honorable members of the club, gentlemen, I would like, first of all, to thank the Commonwealth Club of California for giving me this opportunity of speaking to you today about Libya and international affairs. It is indeed a great honor for me and a rare privilege to review before this very distinguished audience the endeavors of Libya in the international scene. With your permission, I shall proceed with a quick and brief survey of the geography and the recent historical evolution which has led to the establishment of the United Kingdom of Libya as an independent and sovereign state on the 24th of December 1951. I hope that this will give a clearer idea about the position of Libya in world affairs. Libya occupies a choice place on the meridional basin of the Mediterranean Sea, right in the heart of the Arab world, in the Middle East and North Africa, and plunges far into the interior of the African continent. It extends in the north with a coastline of more than 1,000 miles along the Mediterranean. On the east, Libya is bordered in a straight line by Egypt and the Sudan, and on the south by the Sudan and what used to be known as Equatorial French Africa, Western French Africa, and the Great Sahara Desert. Finally, Libya adjoins with Tunisia and Algeria from the west. Libya is composed of three natural regions: Tripolitania in the west, Cyrenaica in the east, and the Fezzan in the south. It covers an extensive area of nearly 1 million square miles, 1,750,000 square kilometers, and has a population of about 1,300,000 inhabitants. The population is composed of Muslims, Muslim Arabs, offering a large homogeneity on account of a commonness of language, religion, history and lot, habits and traditions. The long struggle of the Libyans against foreign domination, their effective participation in the effort of liberation of their country on the side of the Allies during the Second World War campaign of Africa, their strong aspirations to self-determination and independence have effectively contributed to the realization of a national feeling in the modern acceptation of the word, now deeply rooted throughout the whole country. Moreover, the sense of nationhood is strengthened by the fact that the Libyans, who severely suffered from the foreign occupation of their country, are presently enjoying the benefits of independence in the attainment of their full dignity and the fulfillment of their national government for their welfare in the fields of public health, education, and the raising of their standard of living. When Italy invaded Libya on the 1st of October 1911, the Libyans determined to defend their country against foreign domination. Their lengthy resistance, inspired and led by Sayyid Idris al-Mahdi al-Sanusi, their spiritual and political leader, did not come to an end until 1932. Then the Free Libyans took refuge in the neighboring countries, in Egypt, Tunisia, the Chad, and in the Arab countries in the Near East. In 1940, again, inspired and led by Sayyid Idris, the Free Libyans outside their homeland, with the support of the patriots inside their country, resumed their struggle on the side of the Allies in order to liberate their country and to contribute to the combat against fascist and Nazi philosophies and ambitions. Following the victory of the Allies, the Treaty of Peace with Italy, signed in Paris on the 10th of February 1947, contained in its Article 23 a renunciation by Italy to all her rights and titles over her territorial possessions in Africa. It was also stipulated that the settlement of the future of the former Italian colonies should be determined by the common agreement of the government of the United States of America, the Soviet Union, the United Kingdom and France within the time limit of 1 year from the ratification of the Treaty of Peace with Italy, which took place on the 13th of September 1947. In a joint declaration annexed to the treaty, the four big powers stated that in case of a lack of such an agreement, the question of the former Italian colonies in Africa should be transferred to the General Assembly of the United Nations for settlement. In fact, the four big powers failed to reach such an agreement, and the General Assembly adopted on the 21st of November 1949 a resolution recommending the establishment of an independent and sovereign state in Libya as soon as possible and not later than the 1st of January 1952. On the 24th of December 1951, Sayyid Idris, who was elected by the National Constituent Assembly as the first king of Libya, proclaimed the coming into being of the United Kingdom of Libya. The newly born state was immediately recognized by the Community of Nations. Early in 1956, Libya was admitted as a full member of the United Nations. Libya, born as an independent and sovereign state under the auspices and with the guidance of the United Nations, has been constantly prompted since the declaration of her independence by the most ardent and sincere desire to carry out her obligations and responsibilities in the international field in accordance with the ideals and the principles of the United Nations. The confidence of the Libyans in the United Nations and their attachment to the high principles of self-determination, mutual cooperation, and good neighboring among nations was furthermore strengthened by the just and equitable solution of their own cause by the United Nations in the final settlement of the future of the former Italian colonies in Africa within the General Assembly. The valuable advice given from 1949 till 1952 by the United Nations to the Libyans in order to help them establish an independent and sovereign state of their own, and the generous and disinterested aid extended to the newly formed state by the international organization, especially in the field of technical assistance, have created between the United Nations and the Libyan people the most friendly and close ties. Moreover, this special relationship encouraged the Libyans and their successive governments in their endeavors to maintain and preserve order and stability and carry out their responsibilities to safeguard peace and security in the Middle Eastern and African scene. When Libya became a full member of the United Nations, she actively participated in all the efforts for the promotion of international tranquility and harmony, and cooperated within the many specialized agencies of the United Nations in their various fields of activity. Inspired and deeply penetrated by a sense of loyalty and conviction in the effectivity, in the efficiency of the United Nations for the furtherance of international understanding and cooperation, Libya has done her utmost to serve sincerely the purposes and aims of the organization. In doing so, the United Kingdom of Libya is first faithfully interpreting the warm and friendly feelings of the Libyan people towards the United Nations organization and their strong belief in the necessity of its continuance as an instrument of peace and security in the world and as a means for the development of a profitable cooperation among all nations and an ultimate hope for all those who are still striving for the attainment of human dignity and self-determination. It was also in conformity with the spirit and the letter of the United Nations Charter and motivated by the fervent hope to contribute in the realization of a better world that Libya faced and fortunately succeeded in settling the delicate problems which confronted her after the achievement of her full international status. Thus, it was within the framework of understanding, friendship, frankness, and mutual respect, and in the major preoccupation of her national independence and territorial integrity that Libya attempted and has been able to define her relationship with her Western allies of the Second World War. The efforts displayed by the responsible Libyans in order to settle the relations of their country with the main Western powers have not only helped in the establishment of the ties of understanding I have just indicated, but they have also contributed and still continue to contribute in playing an important part in the promotion of confidence and stability in the whole Arab and African world. These endeavors may also pave the way for the heralding of a new era of friendship and fruitful cooperation between this geographical and human ensemble and the Western world, provided that there is readiness for comprehension on the basis of mutual respect and genuine disposition in view of attaining the sacred values of the dignity of the individual and the free determination of peoples. We believe in Libya that such an approach to the new realities of the Arab and African world will result in the disappearance of misunderstandings and in the ease of tensions. Likewise, it will prepare the way for the most advantageous gains benefiting both sides. At the same time, Libya relentlessly endeavored and succeeded under the auspices of the General Assembly of the United Nations and in compliance with its pertinent resolutions in liquidating the intricate and delicate problems relating to the transfer of sovereignty to the newly independent state following a period of prolonged Italian administration in the country. Conducted with patience and in a spirit of tolerance, sense of compromise, and open-mindedness towards the realities of the new post-world, the Libyan-Italian negotiations, initiated in the beginning of 1953, were happily crowned in October 1956 by the instauration of a new period in the relations between Libya and post-war Italy. These relations, based on mutual respect and fructuous cooperation in the framework of dignity, equality, and the respective independence of the two countries, illustrate the best example of the manner in which the relations between some of the Western powers and the African peoples should be settled instead of the present errings which confront the principles of the United Nations and the free world with the most painful toil, expose the relations with the African states to serious difficulties and accentuate the danger of threats to tranquility and peace in the world. While devoting her efforts and her cooperation with the West in order to normalize a dangerous and sometimes even an explosive situation, Libya is convinced that the practice of an outdated colonialism, which consists in maintaining a certain number of African territories and their inhabitants under the domination and exploitation of narrow-minded European minorities, is one of the most evident causes for the grave manifestations and outbursts of violence which shake the African continent from north to south. The disappointment and despair of local populations in the face of this blind stubbornness, exploitation, injustice, and provocation drive them to seek a last resort in a human impulse for self-defense and an impetus for realizing their rights to an honorable and dignified life. In this respect, it seems that the chief weakness in the Western world, the weakness so opportunately exploited by the forces of international communism, resides in the incapacity or refusal of certain Western powers to lend attentive ears to the voices of liberty and dignity, which echo from those parts of Africa still subjected to colonial rule. This incapacity or refusal is much more incomprehensible and unforgivable when those Western powers resort to the unjust use of violence for the mere reason that those African populations claim the right to enjoy the very liberties, ideals, and principles of which the West declare themselves to be the depositary and the unique champions. It is clear to us in Libya that the imperative necessities for a sound understanding of their interests should compel the West to remedy quickly this situation. The American nation has a special interest in helping the liquidation of this state of affairs so jeopardizing for the West, within which the United States of America assumes the main responsibilities. We are aware in Libya that the historical heritage of the American people and the ideals on which are based their moral and political structure of their institutions cannot but direct their sympathies towards those who struggle for the triumph of the principles of human dignity and freedom, the very principles which constitute the genuine motives of the American leadership within the Western world. Libya has devoted her most fervent efforts in order to establish with her Arab neighboring countries, such as the United Arab Republic, Tunisia, Morocco, Sudan, as well as all the other Arab countries, the most cordial and close relations based on the common convictions of fraternity, friendship, mutual respect, and a common lot. Thus, we believe in Libya that we are working jointly towards the realization of a cooperation profitable for all and endeavoring together for the maintenance of peace and tranquility in the whole area and the prevalence of the ideals and principles of a sound international understanding among neighbors. It was in order to achieve more systematically and more effectively these objectives that Libya adhered as soon as she acquired her independence to the League of the Arab States. As a member of this regional organization, Libya continues to fulfill her obligations therein, firmly determined to cooperate in the realization of the unified destinies of the Arabs and in the establishment of a fruitful cooperation among the member states of the organization and ultimately in ascertaining prosperity and better standard of living for the people of the Arab world. Besides, the Arab League is a suitable regional institution for the maintenance of international peace and security in the sense of the contents of Chapter 8 of the United Nations Charter relating to regional arrangements. Libya, after having participated in the Bandung Conference in Indonesia early in 1955, abided by its principles and undertook to implement its resolution because she was convinced that in doing so, she was working towards a better international understanding and fostering the ideals and aims of the United Nations. Later, as an African state, Libya attended the Conference of the African Independent States, which took place at Accra in Ghana in the beginning of 1958. The Accra Conference was an important occasion for the sovereign African states to examine their common problems, establish bonds of friendship, good neighboring and cooperation among themselves, and promote a better standard of living among the African populations. Libya has constantly been alarmed by the armament race and has, since her admission to the United Nations, actively participated in the continuous efforts made under the aegis of the international organization to bring about agreement between the parties concerned on the problem of disarmament. Libya continues to hope that the race for conventional armaments and the manufacture of and testing of nuclear and thermonuclear weapons will one day come to an end. In this respect, I would like to mention the grave concern caused in Libya and in the whole African continent by the news of the intention of France to carry out test explosions of her first atomic bomb in the Sahara. On the other hand, the colossal expenditures on armaments could instead constitute a factor of peace and prosperity when used to develop the natural resources of the world and raise the standard of living for all mankind. It is in this sense that we are following with the greatest attention the action taken by the United Nations with the view to the utilization of atomic energy for peaceful purposes. Libya is profoundly convinced that poverty, disease, and ignorance constitute factors of despair and disorder in the world and serious obstacles to the development and true emancipation of individuals and nations, as well as to the promotion of harmonious international relations. Consequently, we have been following with satisfaction the assistance extended by the United Nations to the underdeveloped countries and areas, and observing with special appreciation of and the admirable endeavors of the United States government and people in this respect. One of the main causes of tension in the Middle East has been, in the opinion of the people of Libya and their government, the drama of more than 1 million Palestinian Arabs, Christians and Muslims, who were exposed from one day to the next to utter misery, plagues of nature, and deprivations after they have been compelled to leave their homes, their fields, and the land of their ancestors under the blow of the aggression committed against their country during the sad Palestinian events of 1947-1948, which constitute in the history of mankind one of the gravest crimes against the sacred rights of private property, the perennity of the motherland, as well as the fundamental rights of human groups to protection from mass expulsion by means of banditry and terrorism. While waiting for the finding of a just and equitable solution to the Palestinian question as a whole, it is of the highest importance that moral and material assistance continue to be given to the Palestinian refugees through the competent organs of the United Nations in order that they may still retain a ray of hope in the midst of the darkness of miseries, injustices, and sufferings. Of an equally grave concern to Libya is the Algerian tragedy, which is being played for more than 4 years on the North African scene. In fact, the Algerian nation has resolved since then to defend the principles of her free determination right to independence and national sovereignty against French colonial domination. This decision seems to us in Libya not only as a last resort for the triumph of these principles, but also as an eloquent illustration of putting into effect the ideals and values, the banner of which the historical French Revolution itself has hoisted high in Europe and throughout the world. Moreover, we strongly believe in Libya that, contrary to the paradoxical myth of French Algeria, Algeria is an Arab country which possesses all the necessary qualifications for independence and sovereignty, exactly like the other sisterly North African nations, Libya, Tunisia, and Morocco. The horrible war in Algeria, besides its flagrant provocations to the ideals and values of the United Nations, as well as those of the free world, threatens the security of the neighboring countries and contributes to a large extent to the instability in the whole area. In our opinion, the provisional Algerian government constitutes, for the purpose of finding a just and peaceful settlement for this question, the valid party with whom France could conduct the necessary negotiations. It is in this direction that the Libyan government strives by all peaceful and friendly means, and especially within the United Nations. Any similar attempts conducted with perseverance may help to convince France to realize the importance and urgency of admitting the reality of an independent Algeria as an essential factor of her present national rebirth. To the arguments often raised concerning the fate of the European community in Algeria, we respond by pointing to the foreign communities living in the neighboring countries in Libya, Tunisia, and Morocco, where they enjoy tranquility, respect, as well as an increased prosperity, thus offering the example of international obligations freely assumed and the proper type of fruitful cooperation between individuals of different races in full dignity and equality. In concluding this brief review of the endeavors of Libya in world affairs, I would like to thank you most sincerely for your very kind attention and to express to the Commonwealth Club of California my best wishes for continued success in the conducting of its praiseworthy task. I thank you very much.
Thank you, Doctor. The question and answer period will now be conducted by the President of the Commonwealth Club of California, Mr. Gardner Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Marks. Ambassador Mohideen Fekini, the members of the Commonwealth Club of California and our guests have been pleased to have you come in your official capacity as Ambassador from the United Kingdom of Libya to the United States, and to accept our invitation to explain to this audience, as well as to our radio network, both the accomplishments and the hopes of your young country. And now, Your Excellency, your remarks have provoked some questions from the audience, and if you will be kind enough to return here to the lectern with me, we will start the question and answer period with this one, which calls upon both your governmental and your legal background. Why did Libya choose a constitutional monarchy instead of a republic, as did most of the new independent nations?
As I was telling this very kind audience, we have in Libya elected as our first king and I emphasize elected our first king, because we thought that he was the man who conducted our struggle against foreign domination and inspired us in our endeavors. On the second hand, we have chosen a monarchy rather than a republic, because we thought that for the stability and the perennity of the country and the conducting of a parliamentary and democratic life, we can assure these objectives in having a hereditary monarchy.
Now, Your Excellency, two questions which I hope your modesty will not prevent you from explaining fully. First, this one. You use the term outdated colonialism. To what extent was it outdated colonialism in Libya that made it possible for a man of your own caliber to be in a position to lead your nation as of today? And secondly, would you please tell us something of your personal participation in the negotiations of the Libya-United States base agreement? With whom did you negotiate? Where were the negotiations conducted? And in a general way, what was the agreement accomplished?
Well, as far as the first question is concerned, and which regards me, I would like to say very humbly to the distinguished gentleman who asked me this question that the outdated colonialism to which I was pointing permitted me to be able to have the honor of addressing you today, because they have simply expelled me and expelled my parents from my own country. As far as the second question is concerned, the Libyan-American agreement regarding the air base in Libya has been, the negotiations regarding that agreement have been conducted between the two governments, and I have personally very humbly participated in the conducting of these negotiations. They have been concluded in 1954 by an agreement which works nowadays to the satisfaction of both sides. We sometimes have problems, and we try to solve them in accordance with the spirit of friendship and understanding which happily prevails between our two nations and governments.
Two questions now, Dr. Fekini, with respect to the United Arab Republic. First, this one. Is it possible for you to comment on the Libyan views with regard to pan-Arabic nationalism and the possibility of Libya joining the United Arab Republic? Secondly, is Libya's sympathy favorable to national aspirations of her Western neighbors?
In reply to this question, I would like to say that the feeling of pan-Arabism is well spread over Libya. And it was because of this feeling that the Libyan government decided to join the Arab League, which in the opinion of the people of the government of Libya is one of the most effective instruments of realizing better understanding and fruitful cooperation among all Arab states and will pave the way for establishing closer contacts among the Arab nations and work for the realization of their unified destinies. As far as the second question is concerned, I am a little bit confused because it relates to our Western neighbors, and our Western neighbors are, on the one hand, Tunisia, which is very happily an independent state, and the other one is Algeria. And I have commented very extensively, I think, on this point when I had the honor of talking to you a few moments ago. As far as the Algerian nation is concerned, I'll be delighted to repeat that in Libya we believe in the right of the Algerian people to independence and self-determination, and we are very much worried by the very bad war which is raging there, and we are working by all peaceful means, as I have said, to bring about a peaceful agreement which in our opinion could be arrived at by negotiations conducted between the French government and the Algerian Provisional Government.
Ambassador Mohideen Fekini, the members of the Commonwealth Club of California have appreciated very much having this opportunity to have you appear and also to question you. And I might say that the members of the club, and I think all of the San Franciscans, indeed are happy to know that your young nation is in the hands of leaders with your youth and your unique experience. And in bringing to a close the question period, these two for a very brief answer. One guest present says, I note that there are in the audience a number of wool growers from California. Is wool an important product of your country? And then one that you might answer better after you've had an opportunity to drive, as you're going to, down the California coast. Are some sections of Libya similar to California?
Do I read well the wool?
The questioner wants to know if wool is an important product or natural resource of Libya as it is in California.
Wool.
Wool, yes.
When I was speaking of the geography of Libya, I didn't have, unfortunately, enough time to comment on the resources of Libya. And I am very, glad to say that we have in Libya as one of our main resources sheep, and therefore we have wool. And I must say also that the Libyan wool is... The experts say that it's of fairly good quality. It's a little bit greasy, but we do our best to make it work. I would like also to say, as far as the second question is concerned, that I was very much favorably impressed by the similarities we have between the beautiful state of California and Libya. I would like to say that I felt very much at home by the weather and the beautiful hills you have here and the beautiful sea. And I think that we have many similarities from this point of view.
Thank you, Your Excellency, and the best of luck. Thank you.
This is Stuart Richardson Ward, and with me today is His Excellency Dr. Mohiuddin Fekini, Ambassador to the United States from Libya. Just a few minutes ago, Dr. Mohiuddin Fekini spoke before the weekly Friday meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California here in the Sheraton Palace Hotel in San Francisco, and his topic was Libya in International Affairs. Dr. Fekini, you've had a most distinguished career in your new and important nation. You've been Provincial Minister of Justice in Tripolitania. You've been Nasser of Interior and President of the Tripolitania Executive Council. You helped to negotiate that very important United States-Libyan base agreement. And you've headed the Libyan delegation to the now very important Arab League. Dr. Fekini, in opening up the talk which you gave to the Commonwealth Club today, I was very pleased that you recognized that we Americans don't know as much geography sometimes as we should, and so you gave us some description as to the geography of your nation. Would you tell us just about how Libya is bounded, what countries surround it, and so on?
Well, Mr. Ward, it will be a great pleasure for me to give to our American friends, listeners to this program, an idea about the geography of Libya, as I was saying to your very distinguished audience in the club. Libya occupies a choice place on the Mediterranean basin of the on the meridional basin of the Mediterranean Sea, right in the heart of the Arab world and in Africa. Libya extends in the north with a coastline of more than 1,000 miles along the Mediterranean. On the east, Libya is bordered in a straight line by Egypt and the Sudan, and on the south by the Sudan and what used to be known as Equatorial French Africa, Western French Africa, and the Great Sahara Desert.
Incidentally, up there in Tripoli, the city of Tripoli up in the Mediterranean, I was just reminiscing with you, Doctor, that one of the earliest international relationship problems that the United States was dealing with the pirates of Tripoli. That was way back almost to George Washington's day, wasn't it? And now we find ourselves very much interested in the affairs of your nation. And you told the Commonwealth Club today that you believe that a more sympathetic, a more understanding approach by the United States and the other Western nations would result in eliminating the misunderstanding of the Arab nations. What did you have in mind when you said that, Your Excellency?
Well, Mr. Ward, what I had in mind was the fact that in the last half of this century, the relations among the Western powers and the Arab nations and the Arab countries have encountered many difficulties which resulted in a certain number of misunderstandings.
What specifically might you have in mind, Your Excellency?
Well, I have in mind, first of all, the fact that the nations and the peoples of that area of the world have been asking the Western powers, which were dominating that part of the world, to answer their aspirations for self-determination, for independence, and for liberty, and the prevalence of human dignity.
Italy moved in and took over Libya, which became known as Italian Libya, around 1911, wasn't it?
Well, as a matter of fact, following a long period of preparation in the framework of the division of influence of the Western powers in the Near East and in Africa, The Italians invaded Libya in 1911, but the complete occupation of the country did not come until 1932, when, as I was telling the honorable members of the club, the Free Libyans took refuge in the neighboring countries, but to resume the fighting again in 1940 and participate on the side of the Allies to the liberation of their country and the triumph of the values and principles of the alliance against fascist and Nazi philosophies.
What are the economic resources of your country in the way of livestock, for example? What animals? I recall, I think, that you have some millions of, sheep and...
As you know, Mr. Ward, Libya is mainly an agricultural country, and we have many possibilities for grazing. So we have a large herds of sheep, of goats, of cattle, of camels, and other livestock.
You have a large number of camels, which is unusual to we in the United States. You have a large number of donkeys, do you not? Runs into the millions.
Also, yes.
Mm-hmm. And what's your agriculture? What do you produce in the way plant? What are your biggest agricultural
crops? The main agricultural resources of Libya, the traditional resources of Libya, are cereals like wheat, barley, and other cereals.
Oats.
There is also a large forest of palm trees. And olive trees, which would constitute the traditional agricultural resources. But since Libya became independent, we have a very big drive towards modernization of agriculture, and we are planting lots of trees, fruit trees of all sorts, like citrus trees, almond trees, and others. Many new plants have been introduced, like peanuts, potatoes, flowers, and so on.
Are your palm trees date palms?
They are date palm trees, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
We have very good quality of dates.
Uh-huh.
I think I have tasted your dates in California, and they remind me very much of the dates we have in Libya.
Yes. The sovereignty of this newly independent nation of yours after this long occupation by the Italians, I suppose, would be natural. You might have some problems in establishing a new government after all the time it had been ruled by Italy?
Well, we have encountered, since Libya became independent, many problems, especially in running the administrative affairs of the country. And we have fortunately been able, and thanks to the help of the United Nations and other friendly organizations and friendly nations, and mainly the United States of America, to train the necessary personnel to run the administration in the federal government and in the provinces. And after 7 or 8 years of independence now, the Libyan government and the Libyan administration is run mainly by Libyans, capable Libyans.
We know that in India, Your Excellency, that the British had in some degree trained large numbers of civil servants and of the less important offices. The natives had been given some decades of training in running their own affairs. Did the Italians give the natives that training in Italian
Libya?
Well,
I am afraid that the Italians did not give as many opportunities as the British did in India and other parts of the Commonwealth.
Well, now, you told the Commonwealth Club today, Doctor, several times as a very important part of your talk, that Libya wishes very much to do her full duty in the family of nations to which she now belongs as an official member of the United Nations, and that she particularly desired to promote peace and tranquility in the world. And you remarked that sometimes what you diplomatically referred to, I thought, as an explosive situation, an outdated colonialism arises. What did you have in mind specifically when you referred to outdated colonialism?
What I had in mind, Mr. Ward, was the fact that in many parts of Africa, we have territories and populations subjected to direct economic and political rule by European minorities.
You mean minorities of Europeans living in these African territories to which you refer?
That's right. And these European communities have been living there for years.
How many years? You mentioned Algeria, French Algeria today. What is it you're
talking
about?
As far as Algeria is concerned, you know that France invaded Algeria in 1830. That's to say, I will not hesitate in saying that the mentality of the French settlers, the great majority of them, are thinking in terms of the second half of the last century. That gives you, I think, the idea of what I meant by outdated colonialism.
Thank you. Population-wise, please correct my figures, is it true in Algeria that there are about 8 million natives and about 1.5 million people of French descent who live there?
Well, I understand that the whole population of Algeria is about around 10 or 11 million, of whom are 1 million of Europeans, and the rest are Arabs, Algerians.
Do you think the oil situation, we've had in our Life magazine, Ambassador Fekini, reports of considerable oil findings in the Sahara Desert and in that area in French Algeria and around in the French Sahara, which France retains powers over. Do you suppose that has anything to do with the interest of Europe?
Well, we understand very much that Europeans are interested in oil in the Sahara and in Africa. We know that the Europeans have bad need of oil. They are the main consuming market for oil in that part of the world. And we believe, on the other hand, that the most efficient way to exploit the possibilities of the Sahara in this respect would be the creation of friendly relations between the populations of those areas. And we believe very firmly that if there is understanding, peaceful settlement of questions in the framework of free determination and independence of people, that will pave the way for a fruitful and lasting cooperation among European countries and African peoples.
You referred to several specific problems there. One of them was, you said, in 1947-48, that over 1 million people had been forced to leave the homes of their ancestors, and there have been crimes against private property or something like that. What did you have in mind there, Doctor?
Well, I have in mind exactly what happened in Palestine in 1947. In 1947 and in 1948, more than 1 million Arab Palestinians have been obliged to leave their country because they have been compelled to do so by the terrorist activities of the Zionist organization in Palestine.
Do I understand that your general attitude as we close, Doctor, was that Libya favors, through the machinery of the United Nations and other good agencies, are working out in an amicable way and will pledge its efforts to helping out the peace and settlement of these problems to which you've referred? Well, thank you very much for this interesting and altogether too short interview. And may I now announce that next week, the same station, same time, I'll be interviewing for you General Mark Clark, former Commander-in-Chief in Korea, now President of the Citadel Military College of South Carolina, on the topic, Training Youth to Meet Communism's Challenges.